Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Mary Ellen Gobias from the Federation for the Deaf. So tell me a little bit about the Federation for the Blind.
It's the Canadian Federation of the Blind. Is a membership organization. Full membership is open to blind people. We welcome sighted people as supporting members. We began in 1992 under a different name, the National Federation of Blind Advocates for Equality, and that organization divided in 1999, and the Canadian Federation of the Blind continued the initial tradition of the NFBAE. We're an organization that came into being because there were Canadians who wanted to work with the power of the beliefs about blindness promulgated by the National Federation of the Blind in the United States and to put those in context. We believe that blindness is not what disables us so much as the social attitudes about blindness, and that blind people, given really good training and given a fair opportunity, don't have to lead diminished lives, that we can live the lives we want to live, given training and the opportunity. So, and we also believe that we wanted to share resources with people who had that understanding, and so we've worked hard at building connections with individuals, and that has been very helpful because we've been able to call on people with a wide variety of backgrounds and experiences and share information. But having said all of that about our connections with the NFB in the United States, we're a wholly Canadian organization and completely independent in all legal senses. So in Canada, we have been working on a number of advocacy issues, and I'll be glad to explain those if you want. But first, do you have questions about what I just said?
I was just wondering, what are some of the challenges associated with the work of advocacy for the blind?
The biggest challenge is that in Canada, for the last 100 years, the all the notions about blindness have been shaped by CNIB, which is a charity. And it has a charity outlook, and because of its need to raise funds, it has had to portray blind people as in need of cradle-to-grave service, almost to the point of being cared for. And so one of our biggest difficulties is to be heard as a consumer organization, with its own point of view, separate from the major charity that has been the service provider in the country. The public and the politicians, if they want to know about blindness, go to the service provider, and its focus is primarily what it needs as a service provider. And so our issues, particularly if we are saying something that challenges public stereotypes, don't get heard.
So how do you go about challenging the myths and stereotypes you alluded to?
A number of ways. I think by encouraging coverage of stories that don't fit those stereotypes, and also just by directly saying this is what people often believe and this is what we've found to be the truth, and by challenging policies that are based on those stereotypes or that undermine civil rights of blind people. For example, in British Columbia right now, there is a new guide and service dog law, and it requires that all guide and service dogs be registered with the province of British Columbia. And in fact, in the very definition of guide dog is the requirement that the dog be registered, that the team be registered in British Columbia, which means that if you come to British Columbia from Ontario or Alberta or the United States or Europe and you are challenged in any way, your guide dog is not a legal guide dog for the purposes of the Guide and Service Dog Act, which means that if you're discriminated against, you cannot use that act to protect your rights. You can, if you know about it in advance and take the time to do it, you can get your dog registered in BC so that it will be protected under the act. But if you don't know about it or don't get that done, your dog is not protected. You do have human rights legislation protection, but that's weaker protection. And so we're challenging that law. The result of the law and the publicity surrounding it has been that the public has been so conditioned to be worried about fake service dogs that people who ordinarily were allowed to go about their business unmolested are stopped when they enter malls and other public buildings and asked to show identification to prove that they do, in fact, have a registered guide dog. So the latest law, in a genuine attempt to protect against fake service dogs, has created major difficulties for genuine guide dogs and guide dog owners.
So to look at the converse side of things, in your time providing blind advocacy, is there any success story that stands out for you?
Oh, I think there are a couple of success stories that are really important, and most of them are the human successes of people who have expanded their own personal horizons and increased what they believe is possible because of the philosophy of the Federation. We've had one of our major successes and although it's not finished yet, is strong advocacy that the public libraries serve blind people directly instead of relying on the charity model for library service. In most of the country, Ontario has not yet adopted it, but in many provinces, there is now a national network for equitable library service. And that network has a collection of books in alternate format that are owned by public libraries and are available for a loan to any person with a print disability in Canada. And so that even though Ontario is not officially part of that network, any blind or print disabled Ontarian can contact the National Network for Equitable Library Service, and that's NNELS.ca, and request a book, you know, books, look in the catalog and register and receive services if they meet the definition of a person with a print disability. The province of British Columbia and several other provinces began work on that, and we were strong advocates and have done what we can to encourage that development, and we're pretty proud of that. We've also made some progress in, although far from sufficient progress, in getting BC Transit to recognize our right to have stop information. A lot of Ontario bus systems have already automated announcements on their buses. BC had been dragging its feet except in the Vancouver area, and we have pushed them very strongly to, you know, to support our rights. And although we're not satisfied yet with what they're doing, at least because of us, there has been some progress made, and it is very likely that BC, outside of Vancouver, will catch up with much of the rest of the country within the next couple of years.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Thanks.
The new guide dog law strikes me as simply restricting the mobility of individuals with disabilities. If a person isn't, for example, aware of this policy, they might find it difficult to get their service dog registered. Fact is, these people are simply trying to travel, enjoy, live, and experience. What right have we to make the situation that much more difficult for them? And for the other, it would seem that that would simply discourage tourism. It would simply hurt the economy. I know it's simply a matter of protection, that they want to be sure that it is for legitimate purposes. That makes sense. However, making things more difficult on a person with a disability is ultimately self-defeating. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Campus Pride Center is a safe, supportive space where members of the LGBTQ+ community and their allies are welcome. All identities are validated and respected. The center aims to foster a community grounded in empathy and support, to prioritize mental and physical well-being, and to empower youth through education. The Campus Pride Center's core values include diversity, safety, empathy, and education. Visit us on the second floor in Dillon Hall in room 252. And stay up to date with events on our Facebook page at facebook.com/campuspridectr.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Mary Ellen Gabayas from the Federation of the Blind. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Daniel Savoy, Disabilities Target Shooting Coach. So tell me a little bit about your experiences with Disabilities Target Shooting.
Well, first of all, I've been a shooter for many years. I'm an ex-military, and when I got hurt 28 years ago, I was doing a lot of shooting as a military until I got discharged. Life went on and so on, and until that, about, say, 5 years ago, I discovered this fella that was living in Brunswick that helped me to understand that there is such a thing as target shooting for people with disability. So within 24 hours, he ended up at home with an air rifle, a vest, shooting vest, shooting jacket, with a whole bunch of other things, and we set up the whole target shooting, the range itself, into our basement. So we did a little bit of that, and then my life has changed a bit, my personal life. So it's not until 2 years ago that I was able to get and started seriously here in Prince Edward Island. There is an organization under the name of Para Sports and Recreation PI that was able to sponsor or start this whole program, air rifle and pistol, air pistol shooting in Prince Edward Island. So I've been the coach slash trainee, because I'm not yet fully coach. I'm just in process of finishing my coaching experience. But mind you, we had someone from the instructor from the Border Patrol services that was able to help us until I got that. So anyway, yeah, so this is what I've been doing in how I got initiated to the sports.
So in terms of your injury itself, would you mind sharing a little bit about your condition?
Yes, of course. Like I said, I'm an ex-military. I got hurt 28 years ago from a motor vehicle accident. Fell asleep a little in my car, wheel in my car, and I just rolled the car. So I ended up being paraplegic. My injury, my paralysis is at the level of T10, which is fairly low, just enough to have the majority of my trunk, which is in other words, my ability to, go up and down with my body, but I cannot move my legs or feel any part of my body except living with a little bit of pain. So, but my, most part of my body is the upper body is functioning very well, and I'm able to, like I said, for target shooting, able to hold on a gun and do what it requires to do to shoot air rifle.
So, do you use any modified equipment in terms of the shooting range itself?
Yep, we do. We need to. Depending on the disability, for example, in my case, we need to, first of all, the rifle is basically the same that for anybody, able body versus disabled. What is different is the, depending on the level of the ability of the person to hold on to the rifle, to be able to have a good shooting, to be able to shoot properly. And the balance is a huge in shooting, because the person will actually be able to, the person will be moving back and forth. So in my case, I need to get classified, which is classification, and is either you get what we call a SH1 versus HS2 classification. And what it means is that if a person is able to hold the firearm without any kind of devices, and what we're talking about here is a spring. There's a little spring that is attached either to a tripod or to a table. And the person will actually be able to hold on to the gun and shoot on their own, then this person will be able to be what we call an SH1. So that is my case. So I will be receive my classification into the summer of July at the National. But I strongly believe this is what I will be getting. But overall, it's either that you have a little spring to hold on to your rifle, you get somebody that will load the pellet into your gun if you can't, or that you will need also an adaptation. Your wheelchair or any bench will be adapted. Now, into air rifle, there's three types of position. There is the prone, where somebody will actually be laying down on their flat belly. Because we can't do that, we need to be able to have a little table. My table is adapted right to my chair on my wheelchair, so I'm able to put both of my elbow right on the table and shoot from a prone position. Now, if we are shooting into a kneeling position, What I'm required to do is to remove one of my elbow off the table and shoot from there from a sling, with a sling on my rifle. Or, with standing position, there's no table at all. So I will be required to shoot with my rifle, holding my rifle into a shooting position and shoot from there.
So
now, Ken, one thing that I forgot to mention is that the wheelchair itself plays also a huge role. There is some very specific classification and rules that we need to be really strictly following when it comes to wheelchair. Now, my wheelchair needs to be into, sometimes when people have a problem with their balance, what they do is they tilt the wheelchair a little bit, and it helps them with their balance when it comes to people that have a disability. Now, you can't have any of that, and the backrest needs to be a very specific height depending on the disability itself, enough to be safe, but not enough to give a person advantage in order to be able to shoot better than somebody else that wouldn't have it.
So, if you could send any message to the community about the need to keep pursuing your dreams and your skills despite any injury, what would you say?
When it comes to shooting?
Yes, in your case, as an outlet for just continuing to do what you're...
Well, life move on, Kim. Depending on the type of the injury that you have, and of course, depending on how long you've been injured, there's different phases when someone is adapting to a disability or an injury. In my case, I've been paraplegic for almost 29 years now. And I remember specifically at first, everything, you need to adapt. It's almost like you need to go through the stages of grieving your old self and being able to accepting the birth of a new person, which is basically my new body. Now, in my case, I really discovered that life moves on, and depending on your ability to identify some of the things that you are able to do, there's always little things out there that allows you to do it. There's always some support. There's always some association. There's always some equipment that you're not aware of that allows you to meet your dream, to achieve your dream. I was listening, for example, to some of your show, and we are talking about, I was listening about this guy that was a quadriplegic, I believe, and he's a pilot. And I couldn't believe it. This is a perfect example of some of the things that that out there, people that have a disability, they need to understand that there is a world out there that we are able to really enjoy ourselves and to do some amazing stuff. Doesn't matter, even though that we have some major obstacle in our life, we need to identify them, and we need to identify the type of things that will help us to overcome those and to enjoy life as in general.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yes, of course.
David was exactly right. There's always something you don't know, always something more to be learned, something more available in terms of disability life. Doesn't matter what your outlet is, doesn't matter what you're passionate about, there's always a way. My work has given me the privilege of interviewing people with disabilities who've done remarkable things, who've exceeded human expectations. Sometimes, as a people, we're tempted to look at disability and to downplay it or underestimate it. But the fact is, no matter what the disability is, there is always hope, there is always potential. There is not a person among us who cannot achieve if given the right opportunities, the right adaptations, and just a little understanding from society. It's easy for us to keep closed minds. It's easy for us to say, these people, they're to be sheltered, they're to be protected, they're never going to live, they're never going to face what life is really all about. In the sense of protection, yeah, maybe there are certain things that we all should not have to face. But, by the same token, you're also denying them a remarkable opportunity. An opportunity to live, and to experience. Earlier, I mentioned this new guide dog law, but honestly, that really bothers me. Just going through this whole process to spend a couple of days in a place like BC, which I'm sure is very beautiful, that really should not be a deterrent. It shouldn't. A person with a disability who wants to travel should travel. Should take in the wonders of what a place has to offer. They should just be allowed to experience and appreciate just like anyone else in society. Maybe there are certain protections in place for a reason, but it all comes down to what we are, as a people are willing to accept. Are we willing to accept that a person with a guide dog actually needs a guide dog, or that a man who once served his country very proudly can still do what he was trained to do and influence others to recognize their own potentials? If we keep an open mind, absolutely we can do these things. But the question is, are we willing to accept a person for who and what they are? Are we willing to look at the skill set and say, okay, these are the factors. How can I work with them? And the answer, my friends, is never, ever to say there's nothing that can be done. There's no way. There's no hope. If that's the answer you come up with, it's the wrong one. If you're someone with a story of disability life, write HandyLink 4, HandyLink, the numeral 4, gmail.com. Always love to hear you folks' stories. For the fact is, disability life, able-bodied life, doesn't matter. Everybody has a story, something that can be shared to inspire and improve the outlook on things. The show's able-bodied observer, Samantha Newmarch, sometimes she'll share just what seems like the simplest thing for a person with a disability. On the surface, yeah, having accessible housing, it's great. We fulfilled some policy somewhere. But is that all it is? Or are we saying these people are a priority, and we respect their right to access enough to build facilities and places that they can go, they can live productively, safely, happily? It all comes down to how you look at it, folks. It's all a question of, is it just holding the door for somebody? Or is it sending a message to them, maybe for the first time in their life, that you should be included, you should be respected, you should have access? Disability is a toolkit. It is a toolkit for coming to a better understanding of the world as it really is. It is a set of factors, one part of a person's equation. What we choose to do with it is up to us. We can choose to look away or to be fearful. We can say, I can never accept this person fully, not embrace their story or be a part of their lives. Or we can say, this is a beautiful, capable human being, and I believe that they have something to contribute, not just to the greater world, but to my story as well. How can we grow as people when we just meet the same type of thing over and over again? The answer is, we can't. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. You've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.